Well, turn back, if you would, to Esther chapters 5 and 6, or second half of chapter 5, and then into chapter 6 that we're looking at this morning together in the drama of Esther that we've been thinking of. And I've given it the title this morning, While You Were Sleeping. That's not an invitation, by the way. But here we are in the story of Esther, and there is a crisis that is fast approaching. In this dramatic story and the five chapters of it we've looked through so far, the Jews are facing a threat to their very existence. They're facing this ancient equivalent of the Holocaust. As Haman, this man in great power, has plotted the extermination of the entire Jewish people right over this vast empire. We were introduced to the empire in chapter 1, and it's rather topsy-turvy emperor who was in charge of it. And there's this evil henchman of his, something like a prime minister, and he worms his way into the king's elite, and he persuades the king to give out this law. It seems the king has no idea really what's going on at all, and a date has been set. Roughly a year's time still. And a date has been put down in the diary of this empire for the elimination of God's people. And those things stand there on the brink of a knife at the moment in this story. God's people could be in the next couple of months wiped off the map, wiped off the face of the earth. And with it, everything that's bound up with their survival. If God's people are eliminated, not just in Shushan, where the events are taking place, but it says it's right across the empire. For those Jews who are living back in Jerusalem, those who are rebuilding the temple, the threat to them is the same. They might not have heard about it yet, because it might have taken some time for the news to get there. But they're facing the very same threat, and the Jews who might have been dispersed through the exiles to all sorts of other places as well. If God's people are eliminated under this evil plan of Haman, then we will face the failure of God's purposes. How can there be a Messiah? How can then God bless this vast number of the children of Abraham that would one day number more than the stars in the sky? How can those things happen if the Jews are wiped out? There'll be no Messiah. There'll be no line of David to continue. So what we're facing here, the elimination of God's people, the failure of God's purposes, and the potential breaking of all God's promises. If this goes wrong here, and the Jews are wiped out, all of God's promises come to nothing. And yet, two heroes, in inverted commas, have stepped up to save the day. And yet, we met them in these previous chapters, rather muddled, rather compromised. They make their messy decisions. In some ways, they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. They should be back in Jerusalem as well. And yet, here they are in Shushan all the same. And yet, in the last chapter, chapter 4, we saw this turnaround for Mordecai and Esther, and they do step up in the end. They do become bold and brave in the face of this danger. Confident, too, in rescue. Confident that somehow the people will be delivered. And they're willing to play their part in that. And so they fast and put on sackcloth. And Esther asks all the Jews in Shushan to come together and fast for her. Doesn't mention it, but it seems there should be an emphasis there that they're praying for her as Esther goes to face the king, uninvited, potentially facing death. And the king says, whatever you want, I'll give it. What does she want? She doesn't say at that moment. Instead, she invites Haman and the king, to a banquet. And there they enjoy their banquet. That's the beginning of chapter 5. And again, the king asks her, what is it you want? And she still doesn't say. Instead, she invites them back to another banquet in 24 hours' time. And so we have to wait 24 hours between one banquet and the next. What is Esther going to say? What's the king going to say in reply to that? And in some ways, nothing happens till then. The events of the rest of chapter 5 and 6 change nothing. You get to the end of today's reading, end of chapter 6, and things are still the same. The king's law still stands. The decree is still out there in the empire, passed as a law. The Jews are still facing certain death. Nothing has changed for the Jews and Esther and Mordecai. Instead, in the second half of chapter 5 and 6, we have a little side story. We have a little mini story of something that takes place, a mini episode. And yet, at the same time, it's right at the very centre of the book. It's the pivot around the whole story changes. And it all happens while Esther and Mordecai are asleep. And so, what's going on in this passage? First of all then, oh, I've changed it to while you weren't sleeping. Because Haman stays awake, plotting. Haman leaves the banquet and he skips merrily home, joyful and glad, we're told in verse 9. Later on, he will say to his friends and wife in verses 11 and 12, he's got everything. He invites round his wife and his friends. He talks about his wise men later on. He seems to have a whole posse of cronies who come together to listen to him. And Haman tells them, verse 11, of his great riches, the multitude of his children. Presumably his wife didn't need to know that. Everything in which the king had promoted him and how he'd advanced him above all the officials and servants of the king. Here is Haman blowing his own trumpet, getting together his little band of yes men and wife. And he gives his own eulogy of his own amazing life that he's had. His great family, the size of his family. His power, his glory, his influence. Haman has it all, and yet it's all ruined, he says. There's a fly in the ointment. Haman leaves, verse 9, joyful and glad, but when he saw Mordecai, he was filled with indignation. And then he gives this great eulogy and how the wonderful things he's enjoying and all these things that the king has given him. He's even been to a banquet with the queen and king, no less. And yet he carries on in verse 13. All of this counts for nothing. All of this counts for nothing as long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gates. What are we to make of this? There's nothing in it, he says. I've got it all. And then there's a fly in the ointment. Haman points us, doesn't he, to the fleeting happiness of this world. Haman is right there at the pinnacle of success. Why is he so bugged by this one man who won't bow? What's the big deal? Millions of other people are bowing down to him. And yet he's dissatisfied. All he can think about is the one thing he doesn't have. The honour of Mordecai. So his wife and his cronies give him an idea. Well, what you should do is get rid of him. And so they calmly plan at their dinner party the imminent murder of Mordecai. And they tell him to get ready the gallows, to build them that very evening. And then tomorrow morning you can ask the king. The king will, of course, agree. The king agrees to everything you say. And you'll be able to hang Mordecai. Then notice the next phrase. And then go merrily on your way. That's the way they phrase it. They're calmly, happily plotting murder. They are thinking of this despicable evil deed to do so that then you can have a merry banquet afterwards with the king and queen. And so Haman isn't sleeping. Late into the night, they're building these gallows. 50 cubits high was the recommended height. That his friends come up with, which is massive, about 20 to 25 metres tall. It's a little bit like the tower crane sitting over that way, building the retirement flats at the moment. And you can see it. You can see it from our road. When you leave our house and turn down Park Avenue, you can see the crane. And the crane's probably about 20 metres tall here. That's Haman's plan. To have this massive tower crane-like gallows there that you could see right the way across Shushan. And Haman plans to go first thing in the morning to visit the king who never turns down his requests anyway. And so Haman has got it all sorted. He goes early in the morning to get it rubber stamped. The plan's all crystal clear in his mind. And it seems inevitable, doesn't it, that Mordecai is going to be killed. What's going to happen first thing tomorrow morning? There's going to be a bang on the door at Mordecai's house. The guards are going to smash down the door as the riot police move in. They're going to take Mordecai, put a rope round his neck, and haul him 20 metres into the air to dangle there until he's dead. Across, as the dawn breaks over Shushan, people are going to see a body dangling above the rooftops of Mordecai the Jew. It seems totally inevitable, doesn't it? What could possibly go wrong in Haman's plan? And who is going to do anything to stop it? Esther and Mordecai are heroes on which are hanging our hope for something that might happen in this story. They're asleep. We might read this story and sort of imagine it more as sort of a pantomime sketch, as it were. And Esther and Mordecai are tucked away in their homes, and we want to shout to the Mordecai, wake up! There's a threat to your very life. While you're sleeping, you've got no idea of the disaster that is facing you. And it seems so inevitable that nothing can possibly stand between Haman and the murder he is plotting. And yet, the story carries on with what seems to be a perfect coincidence, with just the perfect timing and the perfect humour thrown in for good measure. For there's somebody else who can't sleep. While Haman spends the night awake plotting the downfall of Mordecai, chapter 6 tells us there was another person who couldn't sleep. That night the king could not sleep. So one was commanded to bring in the books of the records of the chronicles, and they were read before the king. Ahasuerus is up all night. The king can't sleep. And so he calls for the perfect bedtime story, the royal records. If that doesn't put you to sleep, nothing will. Or maybe there's something else going on in this as well. Sometimes they were very superstitious about dreams and things like that that happened in the night. And so sometimes people thought, well, if you were awake, if the gods made you awake at night, it's because you'd forgotten something. And so maybe he calls for the records to be read because Ahasuerus is awake trying to remember what he's forgotten. Sometimes I can do that too. Trying to remember what it is that I've not remembered. And maybe that's what Ahasuerus is thinking. It often was a way people thought in their sort of era. And so maybe he's called for the royal records not to put him back to sleep, but to be this sort of prompt for something that's bugging him. And he assumes that's the reason he can't sleep now, although he presumably has slept very well for quite some time, not remembering this. But there he is, trying to remember what it is. And of all the places, the kings love to record all sorts of things of all their great deeds. And so these things must have been great tomes, great bookshelves full of the deeds of King Ahasuerus and all the things that had happened in his reign. And yet the person who's there is commanded to bring part of that royal record, and he happens to bring just this very book. And in it he happens to read just this little paragraph of Mordecai. Maybe just part of a longer reading, maybe they were reading it for hours and hours, all night. But this is the one part that stands out to him. This perfect coincidence, isn't it? There's two people lying awake, thinking of Mordecai, that same night. And this reader reads out from the records of the king, about Mordecai and how he'd overheard this plot by Bigthana and Teresh, two of these eunuchs, two of the king's servants, who'd sought to assassinate the king. And Mordecai had told Esther, Esther had told the king, it had all been sorted out. That's as if they lost their heads. But nothing had happened for Mordecai. And Ahasuerus is alert and awake in the middle of the night. He hears this story being recounted again. And he asks, what honour or dignity was done? What was done to reward Mordecai for this? And comes the answer, nothing. Nothing was done. Right, says King Ahasuerus, we need to reward Mordecai. Who's here? Who's here in the court? Verse 4. I need an advisor to advise me. Who else is awake at this unearthly hour of the morning? Well, it just happens, in the perfect coincidence, that an advisor has just come in to the palace. Haman, verse 4, has just entered the outer court of the king's palace. And this is what's on Haman's mind, to suggest to the king that he hang Mordecai on the gallows he'd made for him. The king's servants say, Haman's here, standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. Perfect timing. Of all the hundreds of civil servants there were, all the princes there were who had loved to advise the king, it just happens. The right one is there in the court so early in the morning. And Haman has his speech already. It's there at the tip of his tongue. He's going to come in bright and early, ask the king to hang Mordecai. And Ahasuerus could have let Haman go first, couldn't he? He said, goodness me, Haman, you're up early. What's on your mind? And Haman would have come out with his story first. But he doesn't. Ahasuerus asks first, with the perfect timing. And even then, when he comes out with his question, he doesn't just come out with the question and say, what should we do about Mordecai? That would blow the whole thing open, wouldn't it? Instead, he asks it in this cryptic way. Verse 6. So Haman came in and the king asked him, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honour? And here hinges this hilarious conversation between two overtired men who've been up all night. A hilarious conversation because they keep using this same phrase. What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honour? Both of them, as we said, have been up all night thinking about Mordecai, but neither of them mention his name. Instead, they discuss the man whom the king delights to honour. And so here builds up this ironic little moment as they're both talking at completely cross purposes without working it out. There they are. One of them wants to kill Mordecai, one wants to honour him, but neither of them have said it yet. And so in this perfect humour, Haman then replies, or thinks in his heart, first of all. Now Haman thought in his heart, whom would the king delight to honour more than me? And so there is this moment. The king uses this funny, pompous sounding phrase. And Haman automatically assumes it's him. As the king says this phrase, what can we do for the man whom the king delights to honour? You can almost hear as Haman's head inflates a couple of inches in all directions, as Haman thinks yet more, well, of course, who else is any possibility? Does anyone come anywhere near my status in front of the king? Who else could the king possibly want to honour apart from me? And so Haman keeps repeating the phrase through verse 7. For the man whom the king delights to honour, that's me, let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, with a royal crest on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the man of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honour, that's me, then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done for the man whom the king delights to honour, that's me. He's thinking through the whole of this, that this is him, and so he adds, piles one honour on another, not realising he's put his foot in it. He's digging for himself a pit, isn't he? He keeps repeating the phrase, we should put on him a king's robe and the king's horse. It's either he's wearing a crest or a crown or the horse's, not really sure which way round it is. And he doesn't stop, he just keeps going. Then we should get a noble prince, someone who's in charge of this parade. And he can parade this man through the city square, shouting before him, waking up everyone in the city, that this is the man the king delights to honour. And Haman, of course, is here. He puts his foot in it. It's almost this cringy sort of humour, isn't it? As we're watching this almost pantomime-like, as Haman just goes for it again and again, one honour after another. And we might want to say, calm down, this is all going to backfire. But he doesn't stop. He doesn't stop. He just goes for it. And then comes the moment his world comes crashing down. And the king said to Haman, verse 10, hurry, take the robe and the horse, as you've suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you've spoken. There it is. The king hears Haman's plan, and the king thinks, perfect, that's exactly it. And there's Haman. He's finished describing this colossal honour of king-like status that is going to be given to someone. And Haman is eagerly waiting for the king to say, righto, I'll sort all of that for you. And then it comes crashing down. Hurry, says the king. You go and do it. You go and get all of that sorted. The robe, the horse, the parade. You do it for Mordecai, the Jew. He even seems to mention those two words just to rub it in. It's not just Mordecai, but the king somehow knows that Mordecai is a Jew. Leave nothing out, he says, lest Haman would try and back out of some of those things and say, actually, that was a bit over the top. No, no, it's too late. Poor old Haman. His world's come crashing down. And so Mordecai is woken up in the morning, isn't he? But not in the same way as Haman plans. Haman was hoping to send in the riot police and have Mordecai dangling on some gallows before dawn. But instead, Mordecai is woken up by Haman himself. Haman's the man standing at the door, carrying his arms, a royal robe. Standing behind him is the king's royal horse. They're all ready for it. What did Mordecai think? As bleary-eyed, he opened the door that morning to find Haman there with all of these treasures for him to wear and to get ready for his parade. And so the city of Shushan woke up that morning, not to see Mordecai dangling 20 metres up in the air on some gallows, but to see Mordecai being paraded through the streets in king-like splendour. What they must have thought. Only a couple of days before, there's a verdict that's been announced that all the Jews are going to be killed. A couple of days later, there's a Jew being paraded like a king through the city streets. If they were puzzled before, which we're told at the end of chapter 4, they're definitely puzzled now. What on earth is going on? And so Haman goes back home. Verse 12, Mordecai went back to the king's gate. Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. Haman goes back home, literally covering up his head, hoping no one will see him because he's feeling like he's going to die of the shame of this, skulking home in the shadows. He comes back home. It seems his wife and all his big group of friends are still there. The wise men are still there at his house. They don't mention it was their idea to hang Mordecai. Now it's all backfired. They say it's all your fault to Haman. And his wife comes up with this verdict on the situation. If Mordecai, before whom you've begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. It's all your fault, his wife says. You're doomed, in fact. It's all over now. You were on the rise, but now you've begun to fall. And it's all in a rather overdramatic sort of pagan way. You know, this is a bad omen. This one setback has doomed you. It's a little bit overdramatic, because, as we said, nothing's really changed in the story. Mordecai and Esther and the Jews are still facing a death threat. That's not changed in this. It's just a little muddled in this. But here we are. We've reached the centre of the story. Because everything is changing. It turns out his wife is kind of right. In chapter 5, verse 9, Haman was joyful and glad. Chapter 6, verse 12, Haman is mourning and ashamed. Chapter 6, verse 7, Haman was planning his exaltation in kinglike glory. Chapter 6, verse 11, Haman has to exalt Mordecai with kinglike glory. And then, while they're still talking, verse 14, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. Haman is hurriedly summoned for the next banquet, and it has this idea that everything's just happening too fast. This little mini story, which was taking place almost just to fill the time, really, between the two banquets. One banquet that happened when Esther had just invited them back for another banquet, and this other banquet that's about to happen, and Haman is hurried on his way. And it tells it twice in those verses. Verse 12, that Haman hurried back to his house, and then verse 14, then Haman was hurried on to the banquet. Because it's all begun to spiral out of control, hasn't it? Haman's got no time to think, no time to pause, no time to get things under any control he could muster. He's hurried on his way to the next banquet. And we won't say what's going to happen next. But what is it we're meant to learn from this story? Whether you're sleeping or awake one night. It doesn't mention it. But of course, God is in control. He said it several times already in the book of Esther that it's this curious book that doesn't mention God's name. And we said it may be because God does not directly speak to any one of the characters through the story. So they're always left, as Mordecai said in the previous chapter, or in chapter 4, who knows whether you are in such a position for a time as this. It is that kind of question that underpins these things. Who knows exactly what is happening? It seems obvious that God's the one who made sure Ahasuerus was awake, but we're not told that in the story. We're just hearing the story, and we're trying to work out what's going on in it. But it has to be, doesn't it, that God is in control? Because who else would orchestrate such events with such coincidence, such timing, and such humour? Who else would ordain events to happen like this? But the other thing that comes across, of course, in this is actually God hasn't sorted everything yet. There's this very peculiar moment in the story where everything does seem to turn around, and it does seem, perhaps, that things are spiralling out of Haman's control. But it's not sorted yet. God has not resolved this big crisis. For Esther and Mordecai, the Jews in Shushan, and right across the empire, even back in Jerusalem, they're still facing certain death. But you do have a little token. A token here that God is in control. One thing changes in the story. It's not all as Haman and the king plan out. There are things that are outside of their control, even if it is just about a matter of a good night's sleep. There are things they cannot control. This powerful king and his powerful prime minister think they can rule over everything that happens in this vast empire of 127 provinces from Ethiopia to India. They think they've got it all in their control, but they can't even make sure they get some sleep. They're not in control of that. And they're not in control of the rest either. And here's just a little token of these things that God is orchestrating. And it reminds us as well, doesn't it, that our hope in this story does not rest in Mordecai and Esther. They did nothing in the story. Esther's not even mentioned. She might have had a lion that morning. Mordecai, he's up early, but he's the one who's caught off guard with a great big parade announced for him. They're not our heroes. We think perhaps the hopes of the Jews in the empire rest on Mordecai and Esther, but they don't. As we said, because what it is this is the survival of God's people, the continuance of God's purposes, the keeping of God's promises. And so God's the one who's going to get that done, not Mordecai and Esther. And so it is for us. Sometimes we may face difficulties that may not be resolved. There may be some big situation, and we just wish that God would instantly, miraculously sort it all out, but he doesn't. Instead, sometimes God gives us a little token of those things. The story is told of Charles Spurgeon, and his wife was a very poorly lady, had some very long-term debilitating health troubles that gave her a great deal of suffering. And once Spurgeon was having to head off for a few days, and before he went to see his wife, "Is there anything I can bring you back?" His wife in bed, in great pain, manages to muster a smile and says, "Well, what would make my day complete is if you could bring back an opal ring and a piping bullfinch." An opal ring, like a precious stone, and a songbird, a piping bullfinch. They just laughed, and Spurgeon headed on his way. And then later on that day, he was talking to a woman in her home, this old lady, and she said, "There's an heirloom in my family I want to pass to you. It's an opal ring." All right. The next day, he was down in Brighton, and he met an angry old man who was very angry about many things. And one of the things that was really getting on his nerves was a bird, a piping bullfinch, that just wouldn't stop singing. He said, "You take it. Take it away. Let it go. Let it fly away. Do whatever you like. Kill it. I hate that thing." So there you go. Spurgeon went home the day after with an opal ring and a piping bullfinch. For Mrs. Spurgeon, the pain was still there. Her illness didn't go away. She was still suffering. But there was a little token, a funny one at that, that God was in control. That even if he wouldn't answer her prayer and take away that illness, he still listened to her and loved her all the same, even providing for her these two rather obscure little things she asked for. And so it is in our story, in our life. God doesn't necessarily fix everything quickly and miraculously sort out all of these things. But sometimes we see little signs, little tokens, that God is all the same in control of them. And if you want one token that stands out more than all the others is the cross-shaped token, of course, isn't it? That whereas there may be many things that we still have to live with in our lives, many situations that God does not miraculously resolve, God gives us a cross-shaped token, doesn't he? That he's in control of all things. That he loves us and cares for us. For in a similar style to this story of Esther, imagine all of Satan's effort to keep you and me and the entire human race slaves to sin. Satan wants to keep every single one of us under that threat of death, facing an eternity in hell. And then Satan does everything he can to achieve that. And so when Jesus is born, Satan does everything he can to arrange the elimination of Jesus. He whips up the anger of the priests and leaders He stirs the betrayal of Judas. He frightens the disciples to stay away. He moves the fickle crowds to cry out for Jesus' death. And how Satan must have laughed when Jesus was put on the cross. When Jesus was nailed to a tree, did Satan laugh, thinking it was all over, that he had the victory? But he's never realizing that in all of those things he's doing, as he's trying to destroy God's plan of salvation, Satan never for once realizes the greatest irony of it all, that he's achieving the very thing he wants to stop. Did it finally dawn on Satan on the third day, as Jesus rises from the dead? Did Satan realize, like Haman, he'd laughed too soon? He'd thought it was all over, and then it really was. Like Haman in this story, so it is in the story of the cross. Satan thought it was all over, and then it finally dawns on him that it is, that he's lost. In his moment he thought of victory, but actually it was his defeat. And so we're told that's our token that we hold to. Whether or not you get your opal ring and your piping bullfinch or whatever it is, even if you don't see any of those, even those little signs in life, we know. For as Paul says in Romans 8, for what shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how will he not with us also freely give us all things? Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It's God who justifies. Who is he who condemns? It's Christ Jesus who died, and furthermore is also risen, who is even at the right hand of God, who makes intercession for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? In all of these things we're more than conquerors through him who loved us. That's the token of the cross, isn't it? That in the ups and downs of life, even those situations that are not sorted out, we know God is in control. We know his love and his care for us, for we see it in that token of the cross. Let's sing of that dawn as everything changes in the story of the cross. Let's sing together this hymn. It's not in the hymn books, just up here on the screen. Oh, to see the dawn of the darkest day, Christ on the road to Calvary. Let's stand and sing.